Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show where we discuss a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS FM and HD in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, it's time for a yee-haw. It's time for a roundup. You see, every year about this time, and actually the first Monday of October, and I realize that this broadcast is a little bit late. It'll probably be closer to the first Monday in November, but hey, give us a break. Around the first Monday in October each year, the Supreme Court begins its annual term. And roughly at that time, the court announces what are the cases it's going to be hearing that year. And so I've asked my colleagues at the Appalachian School of Law if they'd take a look at the list that the Supreme Court has released of cases where it has granted cert or agreed to review it on some other basis, and pick out the cases that they find most interesting. And I'm very pleased to say that six of them have agreed to do that and will join me here very shortly. These cases are cases you may have read about in the newspaper or seen on television, and they run the gamut from criminal procedure to First Amendment, and even to some really obscure things involving rivers and navigation way out west. So without further ado, let's talk to my colleague Charlie Condon, the Associate Dean for Information Technology. He's the Director of the Law Library and also a very accomplished scholar and teacher. And Charlie is going to talk to us about a very interesting case involving the police and GPS.
For me, Stuart, it's the search and seizure case, the Fourth Amendment case, United States versus Maynard.
Maynard, okay. What's this about?
It has to do with the police installing a GPS device, global positioning satellite device,
right,
to track the movements of a defendant as he is driving his vehicle around town.
I've heard about this case. This is so cool. This is like a James Bond case.
It is indeed.
Okay,
is indeed.
So what exactly happened? What were the details?
Well, the issue is, of course, do the police officers need to obtain a warrant first,
right,
before they install this device? And the question is, they have to decide, the court has to decide, that is, whether or not putting this device on the car is really a search.
Right. Okay. In fact, let's interject a little bit of constitutional law here. We know we have something called the Fourth Amendment, and it protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. So that's where we have to determine whether we're even talking about a search here before we can determine whether it's reasonable or not. And then the Fourth Amendment applies to the states through the 14th Amendment. So that's where the constitutional law comes in. So is this a search or not? If the cops just come up and stick something on your car?
Well, I think it is a search, and I think that the whole idea of surveillance and surveillance techniques with modern communications technology is putting too much emphasis on electronics and not enough emphasis on human interaction with the actual suspect. My concern is this: back in the old days, if the police were interested in a suspect, they would have to decide, well, where is he and how are we going to surveil him? So they would hide in the bushes or they would hide in another apartment across the street.
Right. So film noir.
Exactly.
Put their gum shoes on.
Exactly.
Okay.
And here's what they did when they got into a car. The suspect would take off and then the police would tail the suspect.
Right.
They don't have to do that anymore if they have these GPS devices.
Mm-hmm.
And so necessarily, if they do have to tail the suspect, they have to decide right away if they're going to commit the resources of time and equipment to follow these people all over where they're going.
Right.
And so it would seem to me that without the technology, police officers and police administrators make a decision on how to use their resources,
right,
to combat crime.
Well, and I imagine the cops see this as primarily a resource allocation issue. I mean, in fact, I imagine the cops are pretty strongly of the opinion that they don't need a warrant or they shouldn't need a warrant because they probably just argue, if I can follow him on the street, if I can follow his car, this is just a more efficient way of doing that. Where's the violation of his privacy?
Well, indeed, and that's the argument that they've made in prior cases. They suggest that this is really no different than being able to observe the person if we're standing there.
Right. And since that's okay, then putting the GPS should be okay, right?
They would argue that.
Right, yeah.
I disagree.
Uh-huh.
And here's why. As technology got more and more popular in society, and as police decided that they could use the technology to their benefit and to the detriment of the citizens, the courts took a look at it and decided that, well, maybe this really isn't the same as the senses that an individual police officer would use.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we need to determine whether or not this is something different than just enhancing the senses of the police officers.
Yeah, in fact, it kind of sounds sort of Orwellian, doesn't it?
It does.
I mean, the cops could, if they put one GPS on one person's car, GPSs are getting cheaper and cheaper all the time. I mean, you can get them in your smartphones these days. So they could just start putting these devices in everybody's car. And then does that mean that the police can just track us 24/7 wherever we drive?
They would like that. It's funny you mentioned cell phones, because the U.S. Congress has gotten involved with cell phones and technology regarding the phone system.
Right.
It used to be that whenever they wanted to find out who a suspect was calling from a landline, when everyone just had landlines, they would have to go to the telephone company and have them install a device that would, what they call, trap and trace all of the numbers that the person called and how long they spent on the phone and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now that there is such widespread use of cellular telephones, the Congress, actually the Congress did this several years ago, back in 1986, they realized that there was going to be a different game now that the technology was changing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Congress passed what they call the Stored Communications Act of 1986, which limited what the government could collect from the telephone company.
Okay, so we've got precedents out there, statutory and I guess probably court precedents too, that acknowledge that when technology changes, that the police are able to do a lot of things they couldn't do before. And so we have to reevaluate whether this new technology allows them to invade our privacy in a way that the Constitution prohibits.
Correct. And I think the basis is going to be that you need a warrant. You need a warrant to do this, because I think the case law is headed in the direction of the court will be persuaded that this, in fact, is a search.
Really? Well, I mean, it does. I mean, when you think, you know, I can see the police's viewpoint. The police have limited resources, perhaps more limited, you know, in times of great budgetary constraint. They want to follow people. This is a cheap way to do it. It's no more intrusive, they feel, than tailing somebody in a car. Okay, I see that perspective. And, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt. They're doing it for good reasons. But you flip it over, do you really want the government knowing every little place you ever go? You know, if you stop at your mistress's house, if you stop at a bank, you know, where they don't know you've got money, if you go and to a political meeting, you know, any of the things that you might just consider to be private, and they can keep track of every little detail of wherever you drive, that's a little bit frightening.
It is very frightening. You put the device on someone's vehicle, and in fact, it's an easy step from putting a device on someone's vehicle to putting it on their person.
Actually, I was about to ask that. If they could do that, these things are getting smaller and smaller. Could they come up and stick one on your coat?
Yes. Yes.
I mean, technically, yeah. Yes. And then you know, then they can follow you everywhere. You know how many times a day you go to the bathroom.
Well, and in fact, they already have the ability to follow you because of the smartphones, as you suggested before.
Yeah.
The smartphones.
Did you hear that, everybody? Turn your smartphones off.
Yes. Yeah. The smartphones.
Or maybe
you
don't want to carry one.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They have GPS information automatically transmitted.
Right.
And so unless you turn that feature off, it's being recorded, and it's essentially allowing whoever has the ability to monitor to determine exactly where you are based on the cell phone towers that the phone is connected to. And the phone is not just going to connect to one. It's going to connect to two or possibly three or more. And then easily between those three cell phone towers, they can triangulate your position probably down to a meter or two.
Wow. Well, this really leaves us with the question about original intent, doesn't it? I don't think the founders probably had much of an original intent about smartphones and GPS systems when they drafted the Fourth Amendment.
I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that.
So I guess it's necessary for us to do a little interpreting on this. Well, thank you, Charlie, for letting us know about this very, very important case. This is definitely one to watch, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I predict that the Supreme Court will say that they need a warrant.
Okay. Well, we'll check you on that prediction.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks to Charlie Condon, the director of our law library at the Appalachian School of Law, for that really interesting and rather disturbing discussion of the GPS case before the Supreme Court. Next up is Professor Buzz Belleville, our esteemed contracts professor and also a professor of environmental law at the Appalachian School of Law. And Buzz is going to talk to us about a case, well, that has to do with business. But don't get bored, because there's some good constitutional stuff in there, too. And it's a case that, well, I'll let Buzz tell you. Buzz, what case do you want to talk about today?
Well, the case that catches my attention, probably because of my teaching of contracts, is a case called CompuCredit versus Greenwood.
CompuCredit versus Greenwood. I'm snoring already. Business case?
It is. I know you're dealing with all the sexy immigration and strip search and First Amendment cases. however, I'd suggest to you that there's a line of cases that's been coming out of this court that has a far greater impact on more people in this country than any of those cases ever will.
Really? Okay, well, now I'm starting to get interesting. So this is not just another boring business case.
That's correct.
Okay, let me tell you,
well, the case itself is actually quite boring, but it's the ramifications and the direction the court is going that makes it interesting. So let me do the boring stuff and get that out of the way first.
Okay.
And then I'll tell you why it's such a thrilling case for me.
Okay, great.
The defendant in this case, the petitioner in the Supreme Court, is CompuCredit, and they issue subprime credit cards for the stated purpose of helping people restore bad credit. Mm-hmm. So they offer up $300. You'll immediately have available to you $300 worth of credit. Unbeknownst to the consumers who signed this, though, there was a $247 in hidden fees immediately assessed when they signed up. And the boilerplate.
Wait a minute. So I'm a guy with bad credit, and I want a credit card. And they say they're going to give me $300 worth of credit to begin with, and they're going to help me restore my credit. I sign up, and all of a sudden I owe them $247 before I even make my first charge.
That is correct.
Jeez Louise.
That is correct. And that's the underlying, that's not the issue before the Supreme Court, but that's what the plaintiffs want to sue about,
right?
This hidden fee. there's boilerplate terms in the credit card agreement that to the effect that the consumers give up their right to join in any class actions, and they have to arbitrate any disputes they have under the agreement.
Oh, wow. Just a second.
Yes.
Now, class actions are important because for precisely this sort of case, an individual person like me, let's say I have bad credit and I sign up, I'm damaged to the tune of $247, but I can't sue over that. Maybe I could go to small claims court. Maybe. It probably wouldn't even be worth my while. And so the very idea is that for class actions, when you've got thousands or maybe millions of people who have been injured similarly, but in very small amounts, and you get to combine those things together, and then all of a sudden now you've got a lawsuit.
Yes, and you have a lawyer willing to take that lawsuit now.
Who's right,
not,
because
no lawyer,
yeah.
No, as I think the dissenting justice in the AT&T case said last year, no reasonable lawyer would ever sign up to take a $30 case.
No, of course not. Okay, so that's the whole reason, is this type of circumstance, but these people have signed away their rights to class actions and indeed even to go to court at all.
Correct,
right?
Correct. And in one respect, this is largely a resolved issue because of the AT&T case last term. The Roberts Court has gotten a reputation as a very pro-business court.
Okay, that's Chief Justice Roberts,
Chief
right?
Justice yeah. Roberts. And most people, when they think of that, or the reputation has been earned through their decisions in Citizens United and the Walmart discrimination cases where they prevented sex discrimination class actions. But a far more reaching one was this AT&T decision that actually overturned many state laws that ruled this combination of you must arbitrate and you can't have a class action. That's been deemed to be unconscionable by many state Supreme Courts.
Okay, so this very language has been rejected on the basis of state law by state Supreme Courts.
In fact, in my contracts casebook that I teach from, there in the unconscionability section, there is a Washington State Supreme Court case that is held out as an example of why of being unconscionable. And the reason being, well, you need two components of unconscionability. You need procedural unconscionability, which you generally have when you have boilerplate form in a big company versus a consumer, and no real choice because other companies, cell phone companies, have these same provisions, so it's kind of a take or leave it. But then you need substantive unconscionability. That is, it's unfair.
Right. Now that's a term we need to define. Unconscionable simply means something that is so one-sided that even though technically both parties have agreed to it, the courts are just simply not going to be willing to enforce it.
Right.
Okay.
Now courts aren't going to interfere just because you made a bad deal or an mm-hmm. unfair deal even. That's why you also need the procedural component, which is usually accomplished through the big business versus consumer and the maze of legalese and the boilerplate language, and not negotiated being a very important thing. You know, it's just something
okay.
that's stuck in front
so
of you.
So this has got to be really, really something that shocks the court. And the court
Correct.
Says, there's just no way we want to enforce this.
Correct.
Okay.
And so a number of states said that when you put those combinations together, what you are doing are, as you explained earlier, effectively denying someone any remedy, because nobody is going to pursue a $30, $60 claim against a cell phone provider or a cable provider or, you know, any of these companies that enter these consumer contracts.
Okay.
Well, the last term, in April of 2011, the AT&T decision came down, which blessed these 5-4 decision, the 5 being what you would expect, the Roberts and Alito and Thomas and
Scalia and Kennedy,
mm-hmm. correct. And Breyer wrote a strong dissenting opinion. So that's kind of the background. This case comes up, you would think it would be decided. However, there is one curveball here, and that is there is a federal statute called the Credit Repair Organization Act, mm-hmm. which gives consumers certain rights in dealing with credit bureaus and credit repair companies like this.
Okay.
And specifically, it says that consumers must be notified of their right to sue, quote unquote, and that is a non-waivable right. So what does right to sue mean to you?
It means to go to court.
I would think the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals agree with you. However, the credit card company has taken the position, or the credit repair company has taken the position that what it means is that you have a cause of action, but it doesn't mean you have to bring it in court.
Okay, this goes to the arbitration part of this.
Very
okay?
good.
According to this federal statute, if I understand you, you can't waive your right to sue people, at least in this credit arena.
Correct.
Okay? So there's a federal statute that says you can't waive your right to sue. And the question is, what is a right to sue? And, of course, most people, just off the top of their head, would say that means the right to go to court. And CompuCredit, is that what it is saying, no, the right to sue means to take any cause of action, which means maybe to go to arbitration instead.
That's correct.
So they're trying to get around this federal statute.
You nailed it exactly. And some other ramifications in that there are certain states' consumer protection statutes which contain similar provisions, both as to arbitration and as to class action. But they're not specific. They're more like, the consumer protection statute might allow the state that its purpose is to allow the accumulation of small claims.
Hmm.
You know, so does that mean that you cannot waive your right to a class action in such a state? Well, I think this decision will go a long way towards addressing those types of issues as well. The fear, of course, now, this the issue before the Supreme Court really doesn't have to do with the class action waiver, but the arbitration provision.
Right.
What we are finding, what is happening is every company is now putting both those provisions in there. The class action waiver is kind of obvious. They will defeat your claim because it's not worth enough for you to bring it.
Right.
The arbitration provision might not be obvious to much of your audience, but if you think about several things, first, arbitrators get paid up front.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so in order to engage the arbitrators, there's a cost to a consumer. So that's
much
that's
more than a filing fee at a court.
Much more. There are no jury trials, so you can't get before your peers who also have credit cards and cell phones.
Right.
There's no discovery, so you can't. The corporation secrets mm-hmm. can't come out. There are secret proceedings, so you can't get to cross-examine the corporation in open court for all to see.
And there's no press scrutiny.
Right. There's no judicial review except in very limited circumstances.
So in other words, the arbitration award is final.
Correct.
So whatever the secret tribunal of highly paid arbitrators decides outside of the scrutiny of the press is final.
That's correct.
That's your right to sue, then, according to CompuServe.
Correct. And the arbitration panels, they're the same people sitting over and over again. There's the repeat customer. The repeat customer is the cell phone company and the credit card company and whatnot. They choose the arbitrators, so there is a built-in bias there already. So all of those reasons are, I mean, these companies aren't stupid. They have teams of lawyers, right? They're looking for an advantage. They're putting this arbitration provision in there for a reason. They think that they get a significant advantage, and they're willing to go to the Supreme Court to defend their right to do that.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and we're doing our first annual roundup of cases, interesting cases that are currently in front of the United States Supreme Court, courtesy of some of the faculty at the Appalachian School of Law. We've just heard from Buzz Belleville, and before that, from my good friend Charlie Condon, the director of the Law Library. After the break, we'll come back and we'll hear from Professor Ann Reif and Professor Kendall Isaac about two other interesting cases. Stay tuned.
Rolling, 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 though the streams are swollen, keep them doggies rolling raw hard. Rain and wind and weather, hell bent for leather, wishing my gal was by my side. All the things I'm missing, good bills, love and kissing.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and it's our annual roundup of cases in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Next, we'll hear from Professor Ann Reif of the Appalachian School of Law, who's going to tell us about a case that involves Israel, Jerusalem, foreign policy, and just all kinds of interesting stuff.
Well, this case caught my attention because it's a political question doctrine case.
Political question doctrine. What is the political question doctrine?
Well, basically, it's a doctrine that bars courts from deciding disputes that are assigned to other branches of government by the Constitution. Under Article 1, which would be the legislative branch, or Article 2, which would be the executive branch. And when the Constitution specifically designates things to other branches, then the courts are just supposed to stay away from those issues.
Yeah, that's interesting. In fact, when I discuss this concept in my constitutional law class, I always say that it's a very poorly named doctrine. Because what it suggests is that the Supreme Court and other federal courts are going to stay away from politically charged issues. And we all know that's not the case.
No. I mean,
just think abortion, right? But what it means is that the Supreme Court and the federal courts generally think of themselves, the third branch of government, as being the non-political branch. They're above the fray. You know, they're appointed for life. They're federal judges. And though we all know that that's not necessarily completely true, that's the way they perceive themselves. But they perceive the presidency and they perceive the Congress, the other two branches, as the so-called political branches. And certain disputes, the judges say, should be resolved by the political branches, hence political questions. Okay, now with that background, that interruption, okay, that's what the doctrine is. And so apparently the court is considering a very rare case about the extent of this doctrine. So what's up with this?
Yes, it's been a while since political question doctrine came before the Supreme Court. They've been avoiding them, it seems, in the past. But this is a case where the little Zivotofsky was 3 when this case was filed.
Well, baby Zivotofsky.
By his parent, yes. Mm-hmm. And he's now 8 years old, so you can see how long the political process, the court process takes. Mm-hmm. But he is an American citizen now. He was born in Jerusalem. His parents are American citizens. And his parents asked that his passport and his birth certificate list Israel instead of Jerusalem as his birthplace, and anywhere else he would have been born in that area would have been listed as Israel. But Jerusalem is a sticky point because the United States is taking a position where they are not going to decide whether Jerusalem belongs to Israel.
Okay, so is it
or
little
the Palestinian government?
Okay, I'm sorry. Excuse me for interrupting that way, but this is interesting. So the Zivotofskys, and they're all still, they're one family, right? They're married?
Yes, they're still married.
Mr. and Mrs. Zivotofsky and little baby Zivotofsky, they want a passport.
Yes.
They're American citizens, and so all they really want to say is where baby Zivotofsky was born.
Right.
He was born in Jerusalem. They want to say it was in Israel, but now all of a sudden the special status of Jerusalem is coming into play, and I'm guessing the State Department is saying no.
Exactly. The State Department is saying that they will not put Israel on the documents. And this is allegedly in contradiction to the Foreign Relations Authorization Act that Congress passed in 2002. that said that the State Department, on request, had to indicate Israel on official documents if an American citizen is born in Jerusalem.
So there's a federal statute that actually addresses this precise issue.
Yes.
And the State Department's refusing to follow that statute.
And the State Department is refusing to follow it because both the Bush administration that was in place when the 2002 legislation was passed and now the Obama administration says that that portion of the 2002 Act, if considered as anything other than advisory, would be unconstitutional.
Oh,
because
okay.
It overrides powers that should belong to the executive branch under Article 3 of the Constitution.
Article 2, right.
I'm sorry, Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution.
Okay, Section 3.
To recognize foreign governments.
You know, that's really interesting. Now we're touching on something else. When it comes to foreign affairs, the president is about as close to a king as the United States is likely ever to get. I mean, in the court itself, the Supreme Court has said that the president is the sole organ of American foreign policy. So apparently President Bush signed did he sign this law? Did he actually issue a signing order?
He did. He issued a signing order.
Or signing statement, I guess they're called.
Right, and in that signing statement, it said specifically that by signing the bill into law, it did not change the United States' position in regards to Jerusalem, and he considered that portion of the act advisory only.
Very interesting. So from the beginning, since the point this law became law, I guess before even, both President Bush and now President Obama are saying it's unconstitutional. They're not going to follow it.
Right.
Okay. But now the Zivotofskys want them to follow it, so they've apparently filed a lawsuit?
That's right. The Zivotofskys want it to be followed because the State Department is going with the past two administrations' policy on this. And they want little Zivotofskys' passport and birth certificate to indicate Jerusalem.
Wow.
I mean, Israel. I'm sorry. Israel as the place of birth.
And I'm guessing that the U.S. government, and that's the Clinton in question, right? Because she happens to be Secretary of State now.
That's right.
Okay, that's the Clinton. It ain't Bill Clinton. It's Hillary Clinton. Okay. She is apparently asserting the political question doctrine as a defense.
Exactly.
So take me through that reasoning. Why should this be a political question that the court shouldn't address?
Well, I'll take one step back, and that is that the defense is twofold by the State Department. One is that it's a political question doctrine that the court should avoid. And second, that should the court decide to hear it, the 2002 Act is, in fact, unconstitutional. So there are those two issues before the Supreme Court on this case. But under the political question doctrine, the defense is that under Article 2, Section 3, the power to recognize foreign governments belongs to the executive branch, and it's not really the role of Congress under this act or the Supreme Court of the United States or any court to take that power away by going basically against the U.S. policy on who owns Jerusalem.
And let's talk a little bit about that policy. I mean, that's not ultimately the legal question, but to understand this better, what's the big deal about saying that little Zivotofsky was born in Israel?
Well, there's still a dispute over who controls Israel. There's been a dispute for a long time over who controls Jerusalem.
Yeah, and Israel, incidentally.
Right,
Yeah, there's disputes all over the place for the last 5,000 years or so.
And the Israeli government's basically been in control since about 1967, but the Palestinian government still has objections to that. And the United States has basically taken a Switzerland approach for years and years and years and said, we're not touching this.
Right, and so, in other words, if the State Department were to list baby Zivotofsky as having been born in Israel, then implicitly they're saying Israel encompasses Jerusalem, or alternately, that Jerusalem is part of Israel.
That's exactly
right. And that's a huge issue in the Middle East.
Right, and it would be a huge issue to the Palestinian government.
Yeah, of course it would. And so this little bitty baby, Zivotofsky, is put himself, or I say his parents have put him, at the center of a huge international controversy.
Yes, and intentionally so.
They did this on purpose.
Oh, yes. It's not a coincidence that this all happened about a year after the 2002 legislation.
I didn't know. Oh, that is so interesting. So these people actually had a baby. Did they conceive the baby for this purpose, or did they simply say, well, we're pregnant, let's go to Israel and have the birth?
That I don't know, but they were American citizens.
That's commitment.
Travel to...
Honey, we've got to make a statement on this. You're getting pregnant, okay?
Yes.
And then off we we go to Israel, or to Jerusalem, excuse me, to Jerusalem, have the baby there, and then immediately make an issue. Wow, this is very political in the generic sense. I mean, in the commonly understood sense, this is very much a political and foreign affairs controversy.
Oh, yes, and these folks have very personal ties to this issue, it seems. So
right.
they're very vested in what happens at the Supreme Court.
Wow, okay. Well, I guess then the court has to decide that preliminary issue of whether something like this, they'll even hear it or not.
That's true.
Or whether they'll simply say, no, this is for something for Congress and the president to work out, in which case it is a quote-unquote political question in the constitutional sense.
Well, thanks to Professor Anne Reif for that fascinating account. See, I told you that was an interesting case. Next, we're going to hear from Professor Kendall Isaac, who's going to tell us about a case involving the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
So, Kendall, what have you got for us today?
Oh, we're going to be talking about a recent case that was just argued before the United States Supreme Court, actually on October 5th of this year.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it's the case of Hosanna Tabor versus the EEOC, or Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Okay. Tabor, T-A-B-O-R?
Yes.
Okay.
More specifically, Hosanna Tabor, Evangelical Lutheran Church and School.
Okay. Well, that's a mouthful. All right.
Yes, it is. It's a very interesting case where we have the school arguing that they should be successful in this litigation against what that was brought against them based upon what they call a ministerial exception, which basically it's interesting because it kind of intertwines the world of employment law with the world of First Amendment and Establishment Clause, the separation of church and state. And it's very interesting in how whether or not the court should even get involved in these types of employment disputes when what's at stake is the possible interpretation of the doctrine of that particular
religion. Oh, that's right. That's right. Okay. So I'm not an expert on employment law, but I'm aware that there's this whole body out there that you've practiced in that's called employment law, like a whole body of law. And, you know, there are certain things employers are not allowed to do. And if the employer does one of those things, then the employee can file the lawsuit over that thing, you know, things like racial discrimination, that sort of thing. But, correct me if I'm wrong now, but religious organizations are allowed more leeway in how they hire and fire and all the rest of it, for their ministers at least, because they have, religious organizations have a First Amendment free exercise right. So they're allowed more leeway. Right? Is that a good statement of the background of this?
That is a very good statement.
Okay.
So I think the moral of the story is if you are in one of those protected classes, such mm-hmm. as age, race, sex, religious,
don't work for a church.
Right. Don't work for a church. Because you may find yourself in a situation if you happen to get terminated or somehow disciplined at that particular entity. So, but what... This case, though, draws an interesting distinction because the real question is what exactly qualifies as a minister in this whole ministerial exception to these wrongful termination type of lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
And again, when I say wrongful termination, it's kind of a misnomer because you can get fired generally for any reason at all mm-hmm. Outside of those enumerated things that we just discussed. But this particular case dealt with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Oh, okay.
And in this particular situation, this lady became ill, had to take time off of school. She had been working there for about 4 years at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Had to take some time off of school, and she was diagnosed with narcolepsy.
Mm.
The school.
Is that where you fall asleep suddenly?
Yes.
Okay, that's a tough one, yeah.
It is, although the school, this is an elementary school, so... The school has some concerns, primarily with the care of the students, which does make some sense if you have kindergartners running around, possibly cutting things with scissors, and the teacher is asleep. You could imagine that there could be some possible...
A bit of an issue.
A bit of an issue, yes.
So she was diagnosed with narcolepsy. She was a teacher?
Yes.
Okay, at a religious school, and they fired her.
Correct.
And so she's claiming that they shouldn't have fired her because she has a protected disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
That's part of it, yes. That's part of her claim.
Part of her claim. And so the church is saying, wait a second, that doesn't apply to us because you, teacher, are actually a minister, at least within, as the defined by the ministerial exception.
Correct.
Okay, now I Correct. Understand. Okay, so what happened here?
And so the other part of her allegation is retaliation, because at the time that she said that she wanted to come back, and then they said, well, no, we don't want you to come back. And so she threatened to sue. And they said, well, basically, if you're going to threaten to sue us, then you're fired. Essentially, I'm kind of cutting to the chase a little bit, but so she was also filing an allegation for retaliation.
Right, but even that claim would possibly be exempted or be prevented if she does actually come under this ministerial exemption.
Yes, that's another. Okay. That's one of the other questions the court has to consider.
Oh, okay.
Because
okay.
technically, the way the exception is under the ADA or Americans with Disabilities Act. And the act itself, it references the ministerial exception. However, the anti-retaliation provision of that statute makes no mention of it.
So we got a statutory issue.
We do have a statutory issue. So her argument and the EEOC's argument is that, well, since it's not mentioned there, it doesn't apply. And Hosanna's argument is, well, the spirit of the statute is the same. And therefore, because it's in the statute, it just stands to reason that it flows throughout the entire statute.
Okay, and let me clarify here. You've got on the one side the plaintiff, okay, the woman
yes.
who was fired. On the other side, and on the same side as the woman, you've got the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, right?
Correct.
Okay, so the EEOC is on the plaintiff's side here.
Correct.
And then the defendant is the church school, okay, that is the employer. Okay, just wanted to make sure I got the lineup correct. Okay.
And to give you a little bit more background as far as her ministerial exception, it's an interesting case because she isn't, quote unquote, what you would normally consider a clergy, a member of the clergy. For instance, it's already been said that the Catholic Church, for instance, if they want to have only male priests, they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Even though some will say that's sex discrimination, it's okay because, you know, that's the whole separation of church and state,
right.
Establishment clause and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in her particular situation, she was initially hired on a contract basis, and she was what they consider a lay teacher. So she taught mainly secular subjects. She did have engage in prayers with the students during class, and she also, had to do some sort of a general prayer for the school, maybe once or twice or three times a year,
right.
Not very often. But primarily her duty was more secular in nature and not religious. After a year, she took some certain classes that they offer, and after completing those classes, she became what they call a called teacher.
A called teacher, C-A-L-L-E-D.
Correct.
She had been called to the teaching,
yes.
Well, I wouldn't say ministry, because of course that answers the question, but she'd been called to teach at this religious school by God, presumably, and she, as part of that, prayed with the children and led occasionally school prayers. Wow, this is getting tougher, isn't it?
Yeah, or she was called, I guess, by way of passing those classes because she was already there anyway. And that's part of the issue is that when she became a called teacher, and they also called her a commissioned minister, the argument that she makes is that anyone could technically call someone a minister for the sake of getting around all of these types of laws, like anti-discrimination laws. So is that title in and of itself a sham and their way of covering over to make it appear that she's a minister when really she's not?
Well, thanks to Professor Kendall Isaac for explaining to us that very tricky intersection between a federal anti-discrimination statute on the one side and the First Amendment, which protects the free exercise of religion on the other. Very tricky area and definitely a case to watch. After the break, we'll come back with two more colleagues of mine. We'll talk first to Professor Pat Baker about a fascinating power case out of the far west, and then about the First Amendment and dirty talk with Professor Doug McKechnie. Stay tuned.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional and our first annual roundup of cases that are currently in front of the United States Supreme Court. Next, we'll hear from Professor Pat Baker of the Appalachian School of Law and a fascinating case involving power and navigation and even the Constitution all the way out in Montana.
Well, the one case that really caught my attention is PPL Montana versus the state of Montana.
PPL, what does PPL stand for?
It is a utility company in the state of Montana that operates several hydroelectric dams on different rivers.
So what's the problem with PPL versus the state of Montana?
PPL operates several hydroelectric dams that are built on different Montana rivers, and a dispute has arisen as to the title of those riverbeds where the hydroelectric dams are located. And the state of Montana claims that they gained title to that property at the time that they became a state. The utilities contest that and maintain that the federal government retained title. And so when it went to the Montana Supreme Court, Montana and the plaintiffs in the case were a group of parents of school children who brought suit against the utilities, claiming that the utility companies had not paid into the Montana School Trust since the inception or since the building of the hydroelectric facilities, and utility companies are required to pay in to the school trust. And
okay, so this gets a little complicated. So the parents of school children wanted more money for their schools. They said, where does this money come from? Oh, it comes from these lease payments that the power company is supposed to be paying on the riverbeds?
Right.
And then it claimed that they had not been paying their lease payments.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so the state of Montana is now on the side of the parents, and it's saying, power company, you owe us money.
Exactly.
How much money was that?
The original judgment was for $41 million in back lease payment and back rent for the riverbeds.
Wow. And how long did that, what period of time did that cover?
Over 100 years.
So for 100 years, the state of Montana has now proven in its state courts the power company has failed to pay its leases. That's a chunk of money.
It is, it is. And there was actually two other power companies in the case who subsequently settled with the state versus litigating it.
Right.
And so they're officially out of the suit at this point. So only PPL Montana is left in the suit contesting the finding. But two other power companies actually settled with the state of Montana.
So there was even more money involved.
Yes.
Oh, this is a big case. Okay. State of Montana might have been late to the game, but once it got in there, it decided, yeah, we would like all of this money. And apparently won, all the way to the Montana Supreme Court?
Right.
Okay, what was the basic issue that was litigated in these to determine that the power company owed this money?
Well, the Montana Supreme Court applied a test for navigability.
Navigability? Why is navigability important?
Well, it's very important because when it comes to navigability regarding title to the land, mm-hmm. i.e. the riverbanks and the river bottom, mm-hmm. if a waterway was navigable at the time that it became a state, title to those lands passed to the state. If the area was non-navigable, then the federal government retained title to those areas.
Oh, okay. So, okay, now I understand. So if these rivers were navigable, if people could actually put boats in them and float up and down, then the state of Montana owned them, and that's the basis for saying that these lease payments should have been paid.
Right.
So the power companies are claiming that these were not navigable back in the day?
Right, exactly.
So they had to go back 100 years and figure out whether people could float boats in these rivers?
Well, and it really has to be more than boats. I mean, when you go back 100 years and you analyze, was this navigable for commerce? The case law seems to suggest that using a canoe or recreational uses do not satisfy the commerce test, that it has to be more substantive when
it comes
to
commerce. Okay, so you actually had to have a fair amount of water flowing on a regular basis in these rivers so that you could float, I don't know, bigger boats.
Right.
Steamships, barges, whatever they might.
Log
floats, that sort of stuff. So you actually had to have a substantial river where people could actually trade up and down this river and use it as a highway. Okay, and they're going back 100 years to figure out how deep the water was and how regular the flow was?
Right, right.
Good. How do you figure that out?
Well, one of the interesting things that the state of Montana does is they rely heavily on Lewis and Clark's journals.
No way.
They do.
Lewis and Clark's journals form the evidentiary basis of this multi-million dollar case?
Right. One of the main pieces of evidence were Lewis and Clark's descriptions of, you know, different parts of the river and navigability and their ability to traverse it, and then, you know, how they discuss, you know, the river's contours and characteristics. And so a major piece of evidence was Lewis and Clark's journals.
That is remarkable. That is absolutely remarkable. Okay. So they go back 100 years. They use Lewis and Clark's journals in the Montana State Courts. And Montana State Courts agree with the state of Montana.
Right.
And against the power company. And so then apparently the power company appeals this to
they
the U.S.
do.
Supreme Court.
The power company appeals it to the U.S. Supreme Court on the basis that the state of Montana applied the wrong test for navigability.
The wrong test?
Right.
What tests are there?
The federal courts have traditionally applied a segment-by-segment approach, and that is some parts of rivers are navigable, other parts are non-navigable, and you can't examine a whole river to determine navigability. You have to break it up into segment-by-segment.
Okay, so if you look at a river and parts of it are navigable, then the state has title to those parts.
Right.
But then if, for whatever reason, you can't navigate through a series of rapids, maybe?
Exactly.
Or a waterfall or something, then that part does not go to the state.
Exactly.
And that's the federal test, segment by segment.
Right. And in the areas that were non-navigable, the federal government retained title to those, and they had the ability to sell them or lease them. And in a lot of cases, that was done to encourage people to settle out west. And so Montana Power bought these power plants and bought this land from predecessors in title who had gained, you know, title to this from the federal government.
Title to the riverbed itself.
Yes.
The non-navigable portion.
Exactly.
Okay, well, if the segment-by-segment test is favored in federal court, what test did the Montana courts use?
Well, Montana Supreme Court, they apply, they find an exception, and they say that brief segments where navigability is interrupted, if it's de minimis, then that does not defeat navigability. So portages would not defeat navigability.
And okay, a portage is where you're floating along a river and then right. All of a sudden you come to a rapids and maybe you have to build a road around it or something.
Exactly.
It's actually called a portage road. And that doesn't defeat the idea of the river still being navigable.
Right.
Okay, so they look at the whole river then as one big segment.
And that's what Montana, they found that despite minimal interruptions to navigability, the entire river was navigable, and therefore the state gained title basically to the entire body of water.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so really it all boils down to, you go back to Lewis and Clark, and do you look at the whole river as a single entity, or do you look at it bit by bit, piece by piece, segment by segment?
And one of the amazing things, one of the amazing parts of the case, is there's a lot of discussion regarding on the 17-mile portion on the Missouri River that Lewis and Clark have to portage around. It takes them 33 days to navigate around the 17-mile section of rapids and waterfalls. And
17 miles seems like a pretty long segment to me.
It is.
Because it doesn't sound very de minimis to me.
No, it's not.
And apparently it didn't to Lewis and Clark either.
No. It took them 33 days to portage around this. And when you look at the United States versus Utah case from the 1930s, litigating the navigability of the Colorado River in Utah, a 4.5-mile stretch of non-navigable water was not de minimis.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well, it looks like the Montana PPL Power Company has some arguments on its side then.
They do.
And the state of Montana had better have some good responses, I guess.
They do. And the ripple effects of this are huge because if navigability, if the test is, you know, as what, you know, the Montana Supreme Court is the way they plot it, if that's the new test going forward, then there's a lot of other states in the union that will have causes of action against utility companies and other, you know, other entities.
Oh, so this could happen all over the country then.
Sure.
Well, in this, what sounded like a quaint sort of little case out of a sparsely populated state that no one else would care about turns out to be a very significant case for all the rest of us. Wow. And it also illustrates how very important history is to understanding constitutional law. Whenever my students complain that there's too much history in my class, I say you can't understand the Constitution without context. And this is a classic example of that, isn't it?
It is. It is.
All right. Well, thank you, Pat. I appreciate you telling us about that today.
All right.
Keep us updated. We'll come back and talk to you later about it.
I will. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks very much to Professor Pat Baker for taking what seems like an obscure power case out of Montana and showing us how very important it is. And I just love the fact. I just love the fact that we're going back to Lewis and Clark to figure that case out. Well, finally, we've got a First Amendment case from Professor Doug McKechnie. And fair warning, we're talking about free speech here, and so there's some strong language that crops up during this interview.
One of the very interesting cases that's coming up in front of the Supreme Court this term is a case that deals with obscenities and
Oh, that's always interesting. Do we get to say some bad words on the air?
We do. And, you know, the last time I was here to talk to you, Stuart, I think this is a recurring theme in our interviews.
We're going to drop the F-bomb?
We are going to drop the F-bomb. As long as you give me the thumbs up, we're going to probably drop
There's
the F-bomb.
There's my thumb. It's okay. Up. But I do want to say that, you know, whenever we talk about the First Amendment, we talk about freedom of speech, that occasionally it's necessary to discuss some language that's unpleasant. And so if there are any parents around, if they're listening to this, they may wish to ask themselves whether they want younger children to hear this, because there will be some unpleasant terminology. Okay, but other than that, we'll talk about it in context.
Okay. The Bush administration came out.
First Bush administration?
I'm sorry, the second Bush administration.
Okay, so we're talking early 2000s.
Early 2000s. The second Bush administration comes out and says, all right, we're going to give you a little bit more guidance. It's not just going to be a contextual approach. We're actually going to articulate a test that's going to help us and those people who produce television shows and radio shows. We're going to create a test that helps us determine whether or not any particular language is obscene and not permissible and can be punished. And the test that they created is as follows, and I'm going to read it here so that your listeners have a sense of what the test is, because it's actually relevant for the purposes of the case that's in front of the Supreme Court now.
Okay.
So the test is as follows. The Bush administration and the FCC under the Bush administration said, here's the test, what's obscene. The question is whether the material describes or depicts sexual or excretory organs or activities, and whether the broadcast is patently offensive as measured by contemporary community standards for the broadcast medium. So that's a two-part test. Now, the second part of that test has some factors that the court will consider. So this is an ever-expanding
test.
Whether it's patently offensive is determined by asking whether or not the explicitness or asking about the explicitness or graphic nature of the description or depiction, whether the material dwells on or repeats at length the description or depiction of excretory functions and organs, and whether the material appears to pander or is used to titillate, or whether the materials appear to have been presented for its shock value.
Okay, so it's only sex or excreting.
Right.
It's only if it's patently offensive, and we're going to look at things like how many times you say it.
Correct.
How graphic you are.
Right.
And whether you're doing it for its shock value.
Shock value or to titillate people.
Titillate. Careful what you say there.
That's right.
You're saying titillate. Now you're shocking me. Okay.
Right.
Oh, no. Okay. So, but, you know, that's interesting, and that's very reminiscent of the obscenity test that the Supreme Court's been using since the 1950s, which the Supreme Court, if I recall correctly, found unworkable.
That's right.
So if the Supreme Court had a similar test, community standards, patently offensive, sex, excretion, all the rest of that stuff, and the Supreme Court couldn't make it workable, but the second Bush administration thinks it can.
The question now is that the court has to answer, because this is the question that the Second Circuit answered, are the regulations that have been adopted by the FCC, are they constitutional? Are they?
So we've finally gotten to the First Amendment.
We're going to get to the First Amendment issue finally. And the question isn't just generally are they constitutional or generally does it violate the First Amendment, but what the Second Circuit made its decision on this kind of second time around was whether or not the FCC's regulations and their interpretation of the law that they're charged to enforce, whether or not its regulations are vague. And that's really the First Amendment issue that...
And that's what shot down the whole obscenity standard for the court itself years ago, dating back to the 1950s. You know, what are community standards? Mm-hmm. What is patently offensive? You know, how many repetitions does it take before a word that was okay becomes not okay?
That's right.
Yeah, and that's the problem with all of these obscenity-type cases.
Yeah, and you know what the court... And
that was the Second Circuit said? It said it was unconstitutional?
The Second Circuit did say it was unconstitutional and that it's vague. And the Second Circuit said, and this is kind of... This is the theory behind the vagueness doctrine with regard to all laws, really, but specifically the First Amendment, is that there's two reasons that a law is problematic if it's vague. I mean, the first thing that's wrong with a vague law is that people are not on notice of what how they might violate the law.
Right.
And so particularly within the context of the First Amendment and freedom of speech, if I'm not certain what I can say and what I can't say, I might just not talk at all. And so they say it has a chilling effect.
A chilling effect, right.
And that's one of the first things that the court is concerned about with vague law, that you may just forego speaking. And we want to encourage people to be able to speak. The second thing is that vague laws often open up interpretation and enforcement to those who interpret and enforce. And so there might be discriminatory enforcement. It may permit those cops on the beat, not literally in this situation, but the FCC in this particular circumstance. It may allow those cops on the beat to enforce it in a discriminatory way or in a kind of an uneven fashion.
Sure. You pick out people you don't like or sentiments you don't like or maybe even political opinions you don't like, and you decide that they're somehow obscene.
Yeah. And interestingly, in the lower courts, this isn't something that would happen in the Supreme Court because people don't testify at the Supreme Court. But in the lower courts, there was evidence put on that demonstrated that, the FCC had found, for example, that words like pissed off, up yours, kiss my ass, whip his ass, those were not patently offensive. Hmm. Dick and dickhead were not patently offensive.
Oh, really? And I would have gotten in trouble for those.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, bullshit was patently offensive.
Okay.
So, and that's actually the Second Circuit's point is it's very difficult to figure out what's going to be patently offensive and what's not.
And the problem is when you draw a line like that, then why is dickhead not offensive, but bullshit is?
Right.
And moreover, and I go back to this count idea as well, the repetition. I remember watching an episode of South Park a year or two ago, and I think they were reacting to that. They said the word shit, and every time they did, a little counter came on at the bottom of the screen. And I don't remember what the count was, but it was certainly in the double digits, maybe the triple digits. And the point is, what, so 98 is right. Okay, but 100 is not.
Right, you know? Right. And interestingly, with regard to the first issue that courts – one of the reasons that courts dislike vague laws is because they may cause people to kind of forego speaking when they might have otherwise spoken. There was also a lot of testimony and affidavits filed by news organizations or broadcast television stations that have said, you know what? We were going to air a certain television show or some newsworthy event, and we decided not to because we don't want to run afoul of the FCC. There was a show, I think it was That 70s Show, where a Fox affiliate said, you know, it talked about masturbation. And masturbation clearly revolves around penises, and penises are obviously connected to excretory.
Well, not necessarily, but I guess maybe in that context it did.
Yeah, I guess.
Let's not be sexist.
That's
here.
Right. Okay. No, you're right. Yeah, and I guess it could.
We don't need to go into detail, no, but at any rate, no. My point is that, yeah, I mean, this is...
So you're making me blush.
Well, I'm blushing myself.
The
point is that you can talk about something, and it necessarily implies a lot of these sexual or excretory functions or organs that are supposedly taboo.
Right.
Right?
That's correct. That's correct. And so it sounds like, you know, you may have come down on the side of the Second Circuit. Now, obviously, the FCC doesn't agree, and they think that they're... their regulations and their interpretation of the law that they're charged with enforcing is not vague and is clear, based on not only this, you know, two-part test that we articulated earlier, but in addition, the decisions that it's made in the meantime since it laid down this two-part test. It says, you know, we've given you enough guidance, not only this test, but then the decisions and the kind of case law that they've created in their interpretation.
Very interesting stuff, Doug. And once again, we've spent a lot of time on this because it's so fascinating. I think that given the content of what you always bring on the show, we're going to do a regular segment with you, and we're going to call it Talking Dirty with Doug.
Well, can you just invite me on for something that I don't have to? You know, because my mom listens to these things.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we apologize to Mrs. McKechnie and to all the McKechnies for making their boy... talk about these serious measures. But no, this is fascinating stuff that you're interesting in and interested in and a very good discussion, a very serious issue. And certainly we don't intend to offend anybody, but these are interesting topics. And I thank you very much. And let us know how this case turns out. Okay?
I will. Thank you for inviting me, Stuart.
Okay.
And that's our Supreme Court Roundup 2011 version. Thank you very much for listening to your weekly Constitutional. My name is Stuart Harris. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.